May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. It's the third Sunday of Advent, and we are well on our way to Christmas. I hope you're not becoming stressed by the apparent need to have the perfect celebration on and around December the 25th. I always get a bit worried by these newspaper articles and magazine articles. We talk about the best Christmas ever. Because if you've had the best Christmas ever, then you can't improve on that the following year. And call me a spoil sport, but I can't worry about finding yet another way to serve Brussels sprouts. And no, I haven't tried the deep-fried ones, which are now apparently available in Norwich Market. Though I have discovered the donut stall outside the Forum. Amidst all the rush and busyness of these weeks, the Sundays of Advent can provide a welcome opportunity to pause and reflect. And if we think of them as stopping places on our journey to the stable at Bethlehem to meet some interesting people. And today, that means Zephaniah, one of the lesser-known prophets, as well as the much more familiar John the Baptist, or baptizer, as modern commentators now tend to call him. And their words, which made up our readings this morning, sum up very clearly, I think, the contrasting themes of Advent. Joy, positivity, and anticipation, alongside something much darker and more challenging. For even as our days are taken up with preparations for the great feast of Christmas, as we celebrate God coming among us, born as a human baby, we also have to remember that beyond Christmas, we should always be ready for Jesus to fulfil the promise that he made to his disciples, that he would return, that he would come again. And if we look at Advent from that perspective, then the practicalities of Christmas lunch become just a minor detail. Our reading from Luke's Gospel takes us to the heart of the challenge presented to us at Advent. We're there. We're standing in the crowd on the bank of the River Jordan, listening to John preach and watching as a variety of people, and it's quite interesting as to who they are, including tax collectors, go forward to be baptised. And I've often wondered what it would have been like to hear John the Baptist preach. Since I've become a lay preacher, I suppose I like to hear other people preach, and I like to sort of make mental notes about it. And I do wonder what it was like. He was, to say the least, an unconventional figure, dressed in a tunic of rough camel skin and living a very Spartan life. And it's thought that before he emerged as a preacher and prophet, he was the member of a very strict Jewish sect called the Essenes, who lived in isolated communities, in sort of desert places, such as Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And I'm sure you remember that John lived on wild honey and locusts. So here's today's interesting fact. The locusts were not of the insect variety, but were seed pods. And they are still eaten today. And listening to John preach, I think, would not have been a comfortable experience. And yet, despite that, all these people came to hear him, I suppose we might almost say, because he was telling it how it was. He wasn't actually trying to sugarcoat the pill, if you like. It was very much down to brass tacks. His message was stern and uncompromising. So, for example, he says, every tree that does not bear fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. And it's no wonder that faced with this, the people in the crowd have this very simple question. What shall we do? They were being asked to face up to the things that were wrong in their lives, the ways in which they fell short and let God down, and the many ways which, if they thought about it, they knew they could do better. And in the midst of the twinkling Christmas lights, the tinsel, and the air of celebration, I think we too are brought up short as we listen to those words echoing down 2 millennia to us today. It's easy, isn't it? We all Christmas, so we get John the Baptist. It's easy to just switch off, I sometimes think, and not actually listen to it as if we're hearing it for the first time. And the challenge and our questioning response to it is surely the same. I'm sure we'd all agree that we live in unhappy and difficult times. We cannot ignore the suffering of people throughout our world, and indeed the world's environment, which is drowning in plastic and pollution. That question, what shall we do, does, I think, carry just a hint of despair. Surely, we think, the problems of the world are just too great. The power and influence of big business far beyond anything that we can stand up to. And we ourselves, well, we're just too human and frail to be able to make dramatic changes to our lifestyles. We try, yes, we really do, but you know what it's like. Is that what we tend to think? John, of course, has a simple answer to the question posed by the crowd. Basically, it's this. There are things that you can choose to do differently. Share what you have. Only take what you need. Be fair with everyone with whom you have dealings. And treat others with care and consideration. And finally, and perhaps it underpins all of this, always be honest. In other words, adopt a way of living which is different from what might be called the way of the world. A way of living which is full of integrity, based on the values which Jesus himself was to teach. I always like to have a suitable book to study during Advent. And this year I chose one which was reviewed in Reform, called Celtic Advent by David Cole. And it's proved to be quite a revelation. In the Celtic Church, and we're talking about, what, the 4th to the 7th centuries, roughly, the time of St. Patrick, St. David, that sort of thing, Advent lasted 40 days, like Lent, so it actually began in the middle of November. So I've been using my book for rather longer than we've been having Advent in church. And the second, and it reflects not only the coming of Christ at Christmas and the second coming of Christ at some future point, these are the markers that we normally expect in Advent, but another coming, the fact that Christ comes into our lives and hearts on a daily basis, a sort of continuous coming of Christ. And during the 40 days, it's separated out into these three sections. If we are to be worthy of Christ's presence within us, then we must be prepared to follow his commands in all that we do. Now, you might think that only people writing modern stuff have anything worthwhile to say. But these are the words of a Celtic monk called Pelagius, who was a famous theologian who actually spent some of his time in Rome, hence the sort of Latin-sounding name, in the early 5th century. The early 5th century. And let us not flatter ourselves merely on possessing the name and being called Christians. Who is so mad and senseless as to declare himself a soldier when he does not know how to wield arms? No one is assigned any name whatever without due cause. To be called a cobbler, it is necessary to produce shoes. It is his skill in his craft which causes a man to be called an artificer or craftsman. For it is by examples of this kind that we recognise that there is no name without an act, but that every name comes from an act. How can you then be called Christian if there is no Christian act in you? He is a Christian who is one not only in name, but in deed, who imitates and follows Christ in everything. Many Celtic Christians found that the best way to follow Christ was to join a monastic community. Lindisfarne, or Holy Island, Iona, the original Iona, that is, and Whitby Abbey are three well-known examples. Monks and nuns lived simple lives, which followed a daily routine or rule made up of worship, study, and work. Now, we're not going to drop everything and go and live in a religious community. It wouldn't be very easy for us, and I think some of us would find it quite difficult for obvious reasons. But it doesn't mean that we can't adapt some of the principles of monastic living to our own lives. And Pelagius had something to say about having a rule as a structure for daily living. I find it really quite hard to believe this is written in the... I suspect the wording has been a bit modernised, but he's writing this in the 5th century because it has such a modern ring to it. In a single day, we make so many decisions we cannot possibly weigh up the good and evil consequences of each decision. We are liable to make foolish and wrong decisions. For this reason, we need a rule, a simple set of moral principles that we can apply to each decision we make. This will not be foolproof, but with a good rule, our decision will far more often be right than wrong. Another reason for a rule is this. Jesus tells us to pray always. Yet sometimes we love to devote much time to prayer, whereas at other times we are dry or feel far too busy to pray. A rule prevents us from making excuses. It spurs us to pray at a particular time, even when our heart is cold towards God. I suppose, if you were to sum up what I'm saying, it is that despite the fact that we may often feel we're in a minority in following Christian values, and I sometimes even think we're swimming against the general tide, we must never give up. For if we don't show the world what being a Christian really means, who will? I was very heartened a few weeks ago when Archbishop Justin Welby visited Norwich. First, there was the wonderful ecumenical service at the Catholic Cathedral, and it truly was an amazing event. I got there, the service was at 12, and I got there, I suppose, about 11:45, and there was the cathedral was filling up, and there was this great air of anticipation and expectation. People didn't quite know what to expect, and it was, you know, a big thing. The Archbishop of Canterbury, the Bishop of Norwich, the Catholic Bishop, and John Potter, who was in the procession, which I thought was rather nice. And of course, he took part in the prayers. Now, the service only lasted 20 minutes, but my goodness, was it powerful. And Justin Welby actually spoke for about 3 or 4 minutes, no notes. Brilliant. And it really was a truly ecumenical event. Afterwards, I found that I'd been sitting next to the vicar of St Andrews at Eton, who didn't know the hymn, Let Us Build a House. Oh, I said, we sing it all the time in the URC. That was the one hymn that we sang. And then on my way out, I met the new major from the St Giles Salvation Army Citadel, which is at the back of where I live, and also my Lutheran friend, Dr Caroline Pahl, and we all agreed it had been an inspirational occasion and showed what can be done when we all work together. The theme was reconciliation, which was very much the theme of the Archbishop's visit. But that wasn't the end of it, because after he'd been to the cathedral, the Archbishop went across the road to the synagogue, where he had a short act of worship there, and then he visited my place, the YMCA accommodation, which is my other next-door neighbour on the other side. And on my way home, I actually met the chief executive, Tim Sweeting, who's one of my husband's former students. So we exchanged a few words, and I suddenly cottoned on, and I said, "Oh, the Archbishop's coming." "Yes, yes," he said, he's coming to visit us." Well, I went in and had my lunch, and then I thought, I'll just empty the recycling bag, and our bins are by the terrace gates, just off Bethel Street. And while I was doing this, I saw this figure go past. I thought, it's the Archbishop. So I shot out the gate, you know me, and I said, "Archbishop, that was such a wonderful service." And he turned round. He was standing in the middle of Bethel Street by this, in the road. And he turned round, smiled and said, "How lovely to see you." So that was my exchange with Justin Welby. And it made my week. And off he went. He went then to St. Stephen's, where he donned an apron and helped to serve lunches. And then he went to the market, where, having, it was all on Look East, he literally wowed the stallholders there. And then he went to Café Britannia, which, as some of you know, is run by the people who run the café at the prison. And after all that, he was then at the cathedral for evensong and then a discussion event in the evening, which I was going to something else, so I couldn't go to that, and then Compline. So his day finished at 9:30 that evening. And then he had two more days. He went on the Caister lifeboat the next day, amongst other things. Oh, and Bish and Chips at the Minster in Yarmouth. And then on the last day, he ended up in King's Lynn doing something with schools at King's Lynn. It was a fabulous event. I think some of it was to do, or a lot of it was to do with the fact that the bishop, you know, he's now finished, and they will be looking for a replacement, which will be a difficult thing to find, I think. I just felt that for those few hours in Norwich, Christianity was very much alive and active and in the real world. And I think it will have made quite an impact on people. And then this week, I spent an hour helping with the St. Martin Street Collection, which, as you know, I like to do every year, and I know there are people here who do it as well. And it was the usual mixed experience. So there were plenty of people who passed by and ignored me and did the usual fumbling around but had no intention of putting anything in the box, which always amuses me. But there were also those who gave. I collected well over £120 in an hour, which I thought was pretty good. And they told of how they bought sandwiches for people on the streets. And there was a lady who'd actually bought a saucepan for someone who was living in a tent. They were very conscious of the fact that homelessness seems to be on the increase year by year. And there was one lovely lady who had been bombed out during the Blitz as a child and could remember her mother sitting in the rubble to make sure that such possessions as they'd got were not burgled, looted, and she'd been evacuated twice, and she said, "I know what it's like not to have a home." And when you hear things like that, it does hit home, I think. But all of this reassures me that in the midst of apparent darkness, and I do get increasingly depressed about the state of our world, sparks of hope do still exist, and if encouraged, can indeed become a flame. The prophet Zephaniah speaks of a time in the future when God will be in our midst, and the lame and the outcast will be exalted. The words which are very much echoed by Mary in the Magnificat. And their message is that we must never lose sight of God's kingdom, because one day it will certainly come. And Zephaniah offers us this wonderful picture of what that day will be like. And it will be totally unlike the present and totally beyond our wildest imaginings. There'll be no more disaster, no reproach, no shame, no fear. It will be a time of transforming joy. And dare I say that unlike the promises of some people on the public stage, I think God's promises are ones that we can absolutely trust. So even as we ask, what shall we do? I think we know in our hearts what the answer is. We need to do all that we can in our lives to be worthy of Jesus, so that we can welcome him into our hearts, not only at Christmas, but on every day of our lives. And the other thing we can do is always to keep hold of that vision of what this world can be like when God's kingdom comes. Amen.